Spectrum One is a big deal. You get Spectrum Internet with the most reliable internet speeds, free advanced Wi-Fi for enhanced security and privacy, and a free Spectrum Mobile Unlimited line with nationwide 5G included, all while saving big. For the big speed, big reliability, and big savings you want, get Spectrum One. Just $49.99 a month for 12 months. Visit spectrum.com/bigdeal for full details. Offer subject to change. Valid for qualified residential customers only. Service not available in all areas. Restrictions apply.
So why do you want to learn a new language? I'll tell you why. Because ¿dónde está el baño? Can be a very important question at times. You know, Rosetta Stone is the most trusted language learning program, available on desktop or as an app. Fast track your language acquisition with immersive lessons designed to teach you to pick up languages in a natural way. I love the fact that I can go from my laptop to my phone to pretty much anywhere and learn the language of my choice. Not to mention, I'm bringing my communication skills to new heights. Don't put off learning that language. There's no better time than right now to get started. For a limited time, StarTalk Radio listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. Visit rosettastone.com/starttalk. That's 50% off unlimited access to 25 language courses for the rest of your life. Redeem your 50% off at rosettastone.com/starttalk today.
This is StarTalk.
Hi, I'm David Grinspoon, and this is StarTalk All-Stars. I'll be your all-star host today, and today's co-host is comedian Chuck Nice.
Hey, David.
How's it going, Chuck?
Hey, man, it's good. Good to see you again.
Yeah, this is great. Really fun to be with you again. And today's topic, we're going to be talking about communicating with extraterrestrials.
Yeah.
Not only that, there's a controversial subtopic, which is the question, should we be just listening, like mm-hmm. we've been doing for maybe 50 years?
Right.
Or should we actually be sending our own messages? Some people think that's the way to go. Other people think that it's stupid because
we don't know who we're talking to, do we?
The bad guys over.
Exactly. You know, you're just kind of putting it out there. You know, just it's kind of like, I don't know, cosmic Tinder. Where you don't get to swipe right or left, you're just putting it out there.
Exactly. We can't necessarily choose who we're going to be dating on the interstellar scene here.
Yeah.
So yeah, there's a reason to maybe for caution, maybe not. Some people think it's silly, so we'll get into that. But today we're going to be fielding your fan questions. We're going to be doing something that we call cosmic queries.
Yeah.
And also to help us get into this subject is a really knowledgeable and enjoyable scientist and science fiction author, David Brin, award-winning science fiction author.
Yes.
And also a published scientist who's done peer-reviewed studies of communicating with extraterrestrial intelligence, and somebody who's been very involved in the discussion and the recent debate about messaging to aliens. We're very glad to have you with us. Welcome, David Brin.
Great to be with you guys. A couple of real brainiacs there in StarTalk headquarters. Beam me up.
Yeah, I see you're in a room with a lot of books. You didn't write all of those, did you, David?
No, I did not.
Just the left-hand side of the room, right? That's all.
Well, as you can see behind me, there is an illustration, a beautiful Jim Burns cover of one of my novels called Sundiver.
Yeah.
So aliens are us. Always been fascinated with the alien. I've always felt as a human being that I was immersed in almost a galactic federation. Humans are so diverse and so weird at times.
Yeah, well, I know a lot of people have felt like they've been abducted by being so captivated reading your books, but you haven't personally ever been abducted, have you, David?
Well, in the 60s, there was a lot of ambiguity about, you know, whether or not I was abducted as an excuse for what you did on Friday night.
Yeah.
But I hear they're still using those excuses in your generation, Chuck.
Yes, as a matter of fact, they are. And I say there's nothing wrong with mind expansion. Drugs? No. Mind expansion? Yes.
Woo!
Right. And, that's one of the reasons we need science fiction. So speaking of mind expansion, maybe we should move into some of our cosmic queries and see what the readers want to hear from us.
Absolutely.
What do you got, Chuck?
So what we have is questions from all across the internet on all the different and varied platforms where we are contained as Star Talk. And I am actually going to jump into something from our Patreon listeners. Patreon is a platform where you can support Star Talk financially. And what it will do is get us to read your questions, no questions asked. So this is Kimberly Henry Carr, and she's coming to us from Patreon. She's a Patreon patron, and she lives in Beaverton, Oregon. She says this: what more have we found out about the new ninth planet? Could this be the home of the fiery balls of light we've seen since ancient Egyptian times?
Wow.
Well, wow.
Wow.
Well, David knows easily as much about this as I do. He's very with it on the latest news in astronomy. Phil Plate is another place, the bad astronomer. I follow all this stuff, even though my PhD is in planetary astronomy and in that part of the solar system, which is where the comets come from.
Yes.
But as a working scientist, I'm a little more hands-off when it comes to Planet X. I'm just as enthralled as everyone else is, and how cool it would be as if we had a ninth planet again. But as far as fireballs and things like that are concerned, well, you know, science has done a pretty good job of coming up with explanations for most of those things. The few that aren't meteoroids passing through the atmosphere, I mean meteors passing through the atmosphere, they were meteoroids when they were drifting through space, and they become meteorites when they hit the ground. The few that aren't meteors are probably phenomena like ball lightning or the ceramic effect, the psychoceramic effect in which people are crackpots.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
Psychoceramic.
Exactly. I mean, with regard to this Planet X, it's important to remember it hasn't been observed, but it's been inferred from some observations of the orbits of other objects that seem to have a pattern suggesting there may be something pulling on.
So now, what you're doing is you're saying that the inference is from a gravitational observance, not an actual body, an object body that we've seen.
That's right. We haven't actually observed it in a telescope. We've observed a possible disturbance, a pattern of disturbance in the orbits of other objects. So now people are predicting where it's going to be and looking for it. And if we find it, it'll be really exciting.
Okay.
Certainly, there are more objects out there in the Kuiper Belt than we know about, and we're just beginning to explore that realm.
So now, what would Planet X be if we were actually to identify it? Now, some people say Pluto is a dwarf planet. Some people say it's not. What would we most likely classify Planet X to be, if there is indeed a Planet X?
Yeah, well, that's a great question. It depends on, you know, by this definition that's been a little bit controversial that the International Astronomical Union adapted, it would depend on if it's cleared its zone, whatever that means. There's, you know, but
I'm in the zone.
If there's nothing,
danger zone.
Exactly. If there's nothing orbiting nearby, if it hasn't scooted everything out of its path, then it might be considered, by that definition, a planet. If there's other stuff nearby, it might be considered a dwarf planet. But either way, if it's sizable and it's pulled itself into a round shape, which it would have to be that sizable to have the observed effects, then it would be some kind of a planet.
Wow. All right. Wow.
Now, and as David Brin said, that this idea that it's responsible for, you know, things we're seeing in our atmosphere, that's not something I'm really that excited about. There's no reason to think that it would be any more than, as David said, that, you know, there's a lot of stuff going on in the atmosphere. Some of it we don't understand. Is it related to Planet X? There's no reason to think so.
Well, let me speak up for some of the science fictional implications.
Ooh.
Because, look, the more we find out about the Kuiper Belt and the Oort cloud, and by the way, I set a novel out in the Oort cloud called Heart of the Comet that I did with Gregory Benford. That's the vast majority of the volume of the solar system out there where it's very cold. But we've discovered from the New Horizons mission, which I cited in an article a little while ago, in which I pointed out that the year 2015 was by far the best year for human exploration of space ever, far more spectacular than the Apollo era. And we're rising up out of this planet and doing incredible, competent things, even as the people of the United States are in this awful, stupid funk of depression and undeserved self-loathing. Absolutely ridiculous that we should be losing our confidence just at the time when we're proving ourselves to be so utterly and spectacularly competent. But if you look at it from a science fictional point of view, that realm out there, starting in the asteroid belt, but even more so out there in the Kuiper belt, that realm is first off more dynamic than we had thought, because the New Horizons probe showed us that Pluto and Charon, its twin moon, are dynamic, that things are happening. The surface is being resurfaced. There's something vaguely like plate tectonics and volcanoes happening, even that far out and cold. But the other aspect is that this is the realm where, if we were visited by alien robots, this is where the robots would have their breeding ground, where they would make copies of themselves, because they could make their copies out there and have their own little robotic civilization out there without interfering in the hot little nursery worlds closer to the sun like the Earth. So as we explore outward through the asteroid belt especially, but also the Kuiper belt and the Oort cloud, that's when we're going to have one of many contact scenarios. And I talk about this in my novel Earth, I'm No Existence, where the possibility is that we would then actually bump into a very ancient civilization of robotic emissaries. And we may be sending robotic emissaries like this ourselves within 100 years.
Wow. So, the idea of finding breeding alien robots munching on Kuiper Belt objects out there is kind of enticing, wouldn't you say, Chuck?
Oh, without a doubt. Just finding them, even if they're not munching on Kuiper Belt objects, is still enticing.
As long as they're breeding.
As long as they're breeding. That's the part.
You had
me at breeding. That's what I'm saying.
All right. Do we have another audience question?
Yeah, absolutely. Let's move on to Sebastian Meyer from Old Greenwich, Connecticut, as opposed to New Greenwich. This is what he says. Let's say we received a response from extraterrestrials to one of the messages we have beamed out into the cosmos over the years, such as the Hello from Earth message. In your opinion, back here on Earth, where in society or in our daily lives do you think the knowledge that we no longer are the only known life in the universe, would this have the biggest impact? School, religion, business, what?
So the question isn't, would it have an impact, or what kind of an impact would it have, but more specifically, where would it have the biggest impact? If we learned about...
That we were not alone.
Unequivocally, if we got knowledge of company out there. What do you think, David, about that? Where would it have the biggest impact?
Well, if you look back at the science fiction of the 50s or 40s, it was assumed that the biggest impact would be on religion, and that people would go all and get all upset and all of that. Well, that's very clearly not true anymore. The world's several of the world's biggest religions, Buddhism and Hinduism, were always compatible with a plurality of worlds. Judaism, it turns out, in the Talmud, there's always been discussion of plurality of worlds. Mormonism is based on that. The notion of plurality
exactly.
of worlds.
Yeah.
And the Catholic Church has in the last 20 years done a very, very substantial and impressive backpedaling on this issue, and is now fully prepared under the tutelage of the Vatican astronomer Guy Consolmagnano. There are some religions that would find it difficult, and some of American fundamentalists have declared, and for no reason that makes any theological sense, that the Earth has to be 6,000 years old and there must be no other life form. But even these, shall we say, very emotionally invested conservative religious types have been hedging their bets. Mm-hmm. There was one I saw recently saying that there's no way you'll find real aliens out there, and we're not counting little scummy mats of bacteria you'll probably find out there, which means they've already accepted the notion that there's probably life. They've merely drawn their line in the Drake equation at sapient intelligent life. Well, it's a legitimate position to take if you analyze the Drake equation and all the possibilities for why we seem to be alone. Probably, in my opinion, one of the top ranked potential explanations is that intelligence is more difficult than we thought.
And believe it or not, we're still having some difficulty with intelligence as we speak.
Yeah, I often wonder if there is intelligent life on Earth, not even just saying that as a joke, although it is a funny thing to say, but that if really intelligent extraterrestrials would look at Earth and regard it as a planet with intelligent life is an interesting question to me. I like to think that one of the biggest effects that such a discovery would have would be on international diplomacy and even inter-ethnic relationships, that it seems as though human beings, when faced with an outside threat or even the knowledge of an outsider, tend to pull together. And I think that faced with the clear evidence that there is somebody else out there that's not at all like us, that we would realize that we are all really like one another. And maybe it's just my wishful thinking or my upbringing, but I do tend to think that it really could have a catalytic effect on the way human beings get along on Earth. And that in turn could help us evolve into some kind of an intelligent species that might be worth talking to from the alien's point of view.
So we would all get together because now there's, I hate to say it, a common enemy.
Yeah, or at least a common other.
Right, exactly. Yeah. But, you know, that's the way human beings do it. Like, you know, we come together because, you know, friend of my friend is my friend, you know, that whole thing. So
absolutely. I mean, I think you couldn't help but feel like our differences with one another were somewhat diminished by the thought that there's somebody out there really different that we are now interacting with in some way.
Mm-hmm. Okay. That's fascinating stuff. I love it. Well, let's move on. We have, this is a bit more of a technical question. This is Camden Margolis from Facebook wants to know, how can we make our planet more detectable using radio waves? Now, you know, you said that there was a controversy as to whether we should, but is there a way that we can actually do this to make it even more detectable?
Absolutely. The question of whether we should is one that David and I have discussed a lot. But David, just how, if you decided you wanted to, how would, and by the way, I only have about a minute here, but how would you make our planet really detectable if you decided it was a good idea?
Well, bring back the Cold War. The Earth was at its maximum detectability during the 1980s. We were very noisy, and then we replaced those huge television broadcast antennas with cable and undersea cables and the huge, gigantic World War III preventing radars went away. So we're a lot quieter now, but even at its max in the 1980s, if you actually do the calculations, I Love Lucy dissipates into noise within half a light year. You would need an antenna the size of the moon aimed at the Earth to be able to detect our diffuse radio signals. Now, there's an exception, and that's coherent laser-like radio beams, and there are about a dozen antennas on this planet that can transmit those. They're called planetary radars, like Arecibo and Goldstone and Evpatoria and Crimea. And these are the ones that the really serious METI people want to use. And fortunately, some of us have been able to stop them, not because we're so totally paranoid, but because we want discussions of the pros and cons before you change a fundamental parameter of this planet without an environmental impact statement.
Right. If we're going to be speaking for all of Earth and making ourselves visible in the cosmos, there's an argument that we really ought to have a conversation about this and involve the people of the planet. We're going to have to take a break now, and we'll have more Star Talk All-Stars when we come back.
This podcast is supported by FedEx. Dear small and medium businesses, no one wants happy customers more than you do. So you need a business partner just like you, like FedEx, who understands your passion for serving your customers because they have the same commitment towards you. That's why FedEx offers you picture proof of delivery, packageless and paperless returns, as well as weekend home delivery to 98% of the US on Saturday and 50% on Sunday. See the FedEx service guide for delivery information. What's more, FedEx Ground is faster to more locations than UPS Ground. Trust FedEx for timely deliveries. See what FedEx can do for your business. Absolutely, positively FedEx.
Whether you're a family vacation traveler, business tripper, or long weekend adventurer, Choice Hotels has a stay for any you. And that's good, because there are a lot of me's. Choice Hotels has over 7,400 locations and 22 brands, including Comfort Hotels, Radisson Hotels, and Cambria Hotels. Get the best value for your money when you book with Choice Hotels. Cambria Hotels feature locally inspired hotel bars with specialty cocktails and downtown locations in the center of it all. Hey, that's me. Radisson Hotels have flexible workspaces to get the most of your business travel and on-site restaurants. That's me, too. And at Comfort Hotels, you'll enjoy free hot breakfast with fresh waffles, great pools for the entire family, and spacious rooms. Hey, that's me, too. I guess I'm just going to have to stay at all of them. Choice Hotels has a stay for any you. Book direct at choicehotels.com, where travel comes true.
If you have kids or pets, you know stains and odors in your carpet and upholstery are inevitable. But the experts at ChemDry can help. ChemDry removes odors and stubborn stains by sending millions of carbonating bubbles deep within your carpet. ChemDry lifts dirt, urine, and stains to the surface to then be extracted away, giving you a cleaner and healthier home. Call 1-800-CHEMDRY or visit ChemDry.com to connect with your local ChemDry and learn about special offers in your area. That's 1-800-CHEMDRY or visit ChemDry.com today.
This is Star Talk All-Stars, and so what do we have, Chuck Nice? We're doing reader questions here, and yes. who's got a question for us?
We got more cosmic queries taken from all over the internet, and some good questions so far. Let me backtrack here, get one that I passed over. This is Nate Carlson from Ottawa, Canada. And this is what he says. With 100 billion galaxies full of stars, there is probably other life out there. Well, thanks a lot, Nate. I'm glad you chimed in on that. But how close together do we need to be to notice each other? If we assume aliens have radio telescopes with similar sensitivity to ours, how far from Earth could they be and actually discern any of our radio signals? So how close would our neighbors have to be that we scream out of our window and they hear us?
Yeah, it's a good question. And that is one of the few questions, perhaps, in this whole field of SETI that we can actually answer quantitatively. There's so much that's subjective and subject to opinion and interpretation, but that's a calculation, and it goes back to in 1959 when the first ever Sirius SETI paper was published by Giuseppe Cocconi and Philip Morrison in Nature magazine, and they calculated that with Earth's most powerful radio telescope, you could communicate clear across the galaxy with another radio telescope of the same power. The problem is, of course, that that's going to take a long, long time. You know, if you're going more than 1,000 light years, it's going to take more than 1,000 years. So there's a time element as well. We have the equipment, and presumably they would have the equipment to communicate over a long distance. But the farther away you get, then you get into these crazy situations where it might take longer than your civilization has been around to have a conversation. David Brin, do you have any comments on this relationship between distance and power and how close the aliens need to be to have a reasonable interaction?
Well, there are two really important aspects to this. One is for about 30, 40 years, we used the classic Drake equation, which said, all right, life evolves in these little places around the galaxy, and that's all we have to calculate. But then it was pointed out that interstellar travel is not impossible, certainly not with robots that might copy themselves. And probably colonization of some kind or another is possible, in which case you're talking about more like spreading zones. And how long would it take for such a spreading zone if you had starships that just traveled 10% of the speed of light and made planted colonies? And then they build up their civilization and then spread out and planted more colonies. It turns out you could fill the galaxy within 60 million years, which is an eye blink.
It's nothing.
Yeah, so the question of where is everybody and why aren't we seeing them is made vastly worse if you allow any kind of interstellar travel.
Right, because then if they started anywhere, they should already be everywhere.
That's right. And so one of the things I talk about in my novel Existence is how when we get out to the asteroid belt or the Kuiper belt, we may find an entire civilization, or perhaps they fought, of various types of space probes that were sent by previous cultures. And we'll probably be sending such self-replicating probes. But the other half of the question is, you know, how likely is it that at any of these spacing intervals, we're going to likely be able to detect others? And those calculations have been done, and it turns out we're at a borderline. The Earth itself would only be detectable to very super advanced aliens with huge antennas that they aim deliberately at us for a year. And then they might pick up I Love Lucy. So right now,
and then they'd probably change the channel.
Yeah, right. The barn door excuse for METI is it's too late. They already know about us. But it turns out that is simply and scientifically wrong. The people who want to use these planetary radars to send focused beams out into space going yoo-hoo, they intend to change the current situation by yelling very, very loudly and very focusedly.
So now the fear of that would be that we attract the Borg. Is that basically it? And before you know it, we're all serving overlords that come here and...
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, you can put it that way, and it's easy to make fun of because there's so much questionable science fiction about aliens coming to invade us. And a lot of people think it's a silly thing to worry about. But David Brin is written about this, and he's actually persuaded me that if you use the precautionary principle, you have to ask, well, can we prove that it's not a threat? And are we certain that it's not? And are there some logical explanations for what we observe that might be consistent with dangerous aliens? And then if you admit that you can't prove that it's not some existential threat, then you have to say, okay, well then on what basis do we decide that it's okay to risk the future of Earth's biosphere?
I got you.
So
it's a big risk.
It turns out that there are mature ways to do this. 20 years ago, the genetic engineering and genetic research communities in biology hold a moratorium on genetic research and had a meeting at Asilomar, California, and came out with better practices, best practices that let us have our cake and eat it too, let us have advances in genetic research while taking some very, very solid and mature precautions. And the NASA has a planetary protection office whose job it is to make sure that the space probes we land on other worlds have been sterilized as best we can, but not in a way that makes it so that we can't explore, but just as best we can. And of course, these precautions are done 10 times, 100 times as strongly if we're going to be returning stuff, you know, to Earth that might infect the Earth. So there are mature ways of doing this.
Well, from what you say, though, it only takes one space herpy. That's all it takes is one space herpy to ruin everything, David.
And those face herpes, you know, the viruses, the herpes,
yeah,
they're this big.
Exactly. Yeah, you know what I'm saying?
We don't want to mess with that.
Yeah, nobody wants to put a salve on the sore that shows up from that space herpes. That's all I'm saying.
we're talking about safe SETI here.
Exactly.
Remember to practice safe SETI, folks.
Well, you know what? I want to switch gears here. Since you guys brought up dangerous aliens, it actually brought to mind a little game I want to play with the both of you. And it's called From the Brain of Brim or the Dump of Trump.
Oh,
so since we're talking about dangerous aliens, I figure what a perfect way to work Donald Trump into this conversation, because David Brin is known for making some pretty brainy quotes and turning a very cool phrase. And Donald Trump is known for saying stuff. So this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to read a quote, and Dr. David Grinspoon, I want you to tell me, was it from actually the brain of Brin, or was it from the dump of Trump? And then David Brin, I want you to confirm whether or not you actually said this. Is that cool?
I'm game.
All right, here we go.
Let's give it a try.
Here we go. Actually, let's see if you know what, and I'm expecting a 100% success rate from you, Dr. Funky Spoon.
I know. If I can't tell David Brin from Donald Trump, then I don't know. I might need to get my PhD revoked.
Okay, I'm going to hold it. All right, now we got stakes in the game. We are playing for Dr. Funky Spoon's PhD.
What did I just say?
If you lose this game, you are no longer Dr. David Grinspoon.
I don't want to have to go back to grad school, please.
All right, here we go. Here's the first quote. Self-righteous people can talk themselves into forgetting that they are a part of civilization. They can feed on that culture, bringing it down. It's happened many times in the past. It could happen to us again. Is that from the brain of Brin or the dump of Trump? Dr. Funky Spoon.
That strikes me as a very reasoned and intelligent analysis.
Mm.
And I'm going to go with the brain of Brin for that one.
Okay. David Brin, did you indeed say that?
He's giving us the thumbs up
through the camera, so that is a yes. And what was the context of that, David? What were you actually talking about when you were talking about self-righteous people? Very quickly. Just so
we're all drug fiends to one degree or another. We get addicted to wholesome things like our children, like our skill and our professions and music.
Science fiction.
And science fiction. And unfortunately, when we can't find wholesome things to be addicted to, we go for drugs or alcohol or gambling. But
now, let's leave me out of this, David.
the easiest drug in the world to satisfy your addictive cravings is self-righteous rage.
Wow.
And if you can return to a self-righteous snit regularly at intervals, and we all know people like that, and we all know that we ourselves are capable of that.
Well, it feels good.
Yeah.
It feels good to be self-righteous. I got to be honest.
It's the biggest addiction of all. I am so right.
Yeah.
And everyone else is so wrong.
All right. Let's continue with our game. From the brain of Brin or the dump of Trump, posing a question to Dr. Funky Spoon to figure out if he can figure out who said this. Who said this? I have never seen a thin person drinking Diet Coke.
I have never seen a thin person drinking Diet Coke.
Was that from the brain of Brin or the dump of Trump?
I am going to go with the dump of Trump on that one.
David, did you ever go on record as saying, I have never seen a thin person? No, he's giving us the thumbs down.
Wow, I'm pretty good at this.
Yes, indeed. You are good at this. All right. So far, you are batting 1,000. But guess what? There is no room for error, because if you screw up, we are taking your PhD.
I know.
Ooh, this game is exciting. All right. Who said this? Okay. Such a simple statement, so this might be a little confusing. I find humans tremendously interesting.
Wow.
The brain of Brim or the dump of Trump?
Wow. Ooh, this is almost a trick question.
Almost.
Anybody could say that. I'm going to guess that you're throwing me a curveball here, and I'm going to go with the dump of Trump.
Now, I'm just letting you know, your PhD is on the line here. So I don't want to influence your answer in any way, shape, or form. Are you sure you want to go with that?
I am going to change my vote. And I'm going to say David Brin said that.
David Brin, did you indeed say, "I find humans tremendously interesting"?
Yes, sure.
Yes, he did.
Wow. Right. I am so good. I'm just following my instincts here.
You better follow.
But you'll notice it's said as if by an outsider.
Yes.
I have been accused of, which I have accused of being in one of my novels. I even lay in clues in one of the, on one of the pages that, that I'm actually the front man for an alien.
Ah, see, so in fact, you and I could be practicing communication with extraterrestrial intelligence right now
and not even know it.
Yeah, that's right.
That's it.
Yeah.
I believe we just got an exclusive here, people. I believe we just found out who David Brin really is.
He really is.
Okay. All right, let's do one more from the brain of Brin or the dump of Trump. Okay. let me see. I'm going to give you the toughest one there is, Dr. Funky Spoon. And by the way, I call him that because his Twitter handle is at Dr. Funky Spoon.
Thank you.
For those of you who are wondering, it's not like I just made up some crazy nickname for Dr. Grinspoon. Okay, here we go. This is the toughest one. If I were running The View, I would fire Rosie O'Donnell. I mean, I'd look her right in her fat, ugly face, and I'd say, "Rosie, you're fired." Who said that? David Brin or Donald Trump?
Well, you know, I've known David Brin for a few years now,
mm-hmm.
and I've heard him say a lot of different kinds of things, mm-hmm. but I'm going to say that is probably from the dump of Trump.
So, David Brin, I'm asking you, did you indeed look Rosie O'Donnell in her fat, ugly face and say, "You're fired"?
I confess.
Oh, no! Wow. You fooled me on that one.
Oh, that's hilarious.
she's never going to speak to me again. or for the first time.
Nah, that's very cool. All right, that's our game. That was good stuff, guys. That was a fun little departure. And let's get back to our cosmic queries and some very serious questions about signs of life in the universe and
right.
calling ET.
What do we got, Chuck?
Here we go. This is from Jeff Carlisle. He comes to us from Facebook, and he wants to know this. Does NASA or SETI have a set of guidelines for what to do in the event of extraterrestrial contact? How do we respond? Does the public find out? How much information can we share? Are they already here? What's going on?
Oh, yeah. Good question. And the answer is yes.
Oh, really?
There is a protocol. The SETI community agreed on a protocol that was widely ratified for what to do if a message is received.
Really?
And it's been much harder to get the SETI community to agree on the next question, which is what to do if somebody from Earth wants to send a message. We've talked about that a little bit. But if we get a message, then the idea is first you confirm it.
Okay.
You talk to another observatory first to make sure they see it too. So you rule out a false alarm.
So it cannot be an anomaly. It has to be a confirmed communication.
Yeah.
A reception of communication.
Yeah. So you don't alert the media when you're still not sure.
All right.
But once you're sure, and you become sure by alerting other observatories so they can check it out too, so it's not just some local thing you're observing. And then once you're sure, the protocol is you alert the political leaders, the media. There's a list. There's a protocol. I can't tell you the exact order, but it's the opposite of secrecy. It's like total transparency once we're sure.
But what we do know is Twitter is not the first to find out. Like you don't just tweet out, "Man, they're here. They contacted us."
Well, it's an interesting question because when these protocols were devised, it was pre-Twitter. But certainly the person sitting there at the telescope receiver, if they're being responsible, is not going to tweet out, "Wow, I think I see an alien." But once the news it's decided that yes, this is good, we can release it. I'm sure social media will play a huge role in that.
Cool.
Yeah. David, do you have anything to add to the protocol for SETI?
Yeah, I was on the committee that drafted it. And one of the bits that I was most proud of was the portion of the protocol that says, and you will leave to the original discoverer the right and honor of making the announcement. Yeah. The protocol already makes it very clear that it's nobody's going to be keeping this thing secret. But by leaving it to the discoverer to choose the time and place for a public announcement, this sets in a little bit of a pause. This sets in a little bit of a delay, a phase factor, so that it won't go out on Twitter, so that humanity has at least that, you know, one day or so or 2 days in which a sage scientist, leader of a team somewhere, can take a deep breath and think about what to say and what to do. I'm the author of The Transparent Society, and yet I think that a 1 day or 2 day delay, you know, for a little bit of pause and consideration may be wise. You don't know what the circumstances will be.
Yeah. Let's just hope it's not my teenage daughter, because it will go like this. I got some big news. Guess what it is?
We need to take a pause now, but we'll continue with our Q&A and wrap this up in a little while. Thank you.
The South Dakota Stories, Volume 5. South Dakota seemed like the perfect place to unplug, but I ended up connecting to the world around me. A world where each sunset was painted, where I felt adventures pulse with every step, and where cold water trickling, pine swaying, and grunting bison became my favorite soundtracks. I just wish I didn't have to leave. There's so much South Dakota, so little time.
Walmart Plus members save on meeting up with friends. Save on having them over for dinner with free delivery with no hidden fees or markups. That's groceries, plus napkins, plus that vegetable chopper to make things a bit easier. Plus, members save on gas to go meet them in their neck of the woods. Plus, when you're ready for the ultimate sign of friendship, start a show together with your included Paramount Plus subscription. Walmart Plus members save on this, plus so much more. Start a 30-day free trial at walmartplus.com. Paramount Plus, essential plan only. Separate registration required. See Walmart Plus terms and conditions.
Look around. You can find cars like these on AutoTrader, like that car riding your tail. Or if you're tailgating right now, all those cars doubling as kitchens and living rooms are on AutoTrader too. Are you working out and listening to this ad at the same time? Well, multitasking pro, cars like the ones in the gym parking lot are for sale on AutoTrader. New cars, used cars, electric cars, maybe even flying cars. Okay, no flying cars, but as soon as they get invented, they'll be on AutoTrader. Just you wait. AutoTrader.
Welcome back to Star Talk All-Stars. I'm David Grinspoon, and I'm here with Chuck Nice.
Yes.
And our guest, David Brin. And we're talking about communicating with aliens, and including the controversial question of whether we should be revealing ourselves to the cosmos, or whether we should be a little bit cautious, not knowing what may be out there. There have been some famous voices out there. You may have heard Dr. Stephen Hawking has famously said that aliens could come and do us harm. David Brin has been cautious, and he's told us a little bit about that. Now, and maybe we'll hear a little bit more. There are other people who say, oh, damn the torpedoes. Let's just send messages and see what's out there. What are we worried about? So it's an interesting debate. My own opinion is that we should, as David says, at least have some kind of a global conversation about it before we just decide that we're going to speak for all of Earth and reveal ourselves for all of time. Maybe we can't know for sure what the dangers are, but it's probably worth at least having some kind of a consultation and not being so arrogant as to say, absolutely, the hell with it. Let's just see what happens.
Man, when you're playing cosmic poker, you don't want to show your hand. I mean, you know, at least until the proper time presents itself.
Yeah, I mean, it is kind of a puzzle. I'd be interested to know what David Brin thinks of this, but when do you know when it's enough? When are we really ready to say, okay, we know enough to start talking? But at least we could attempt to have some kind of a global buy-in. David, do you have a quick thought on when it will be okay to broadcast?
Well, it's not so much a particular sum of knowledge that is my criterion, but the rate at which we're learning. We are like a four-year-old who wakes up in a jungle that's quiet, maybe too quiet, to use the cliche. And what do you do under those circumstances? Well, you try to learn as much as you can quietly, because there are some conceivable dangers. I think Stephen Hawking exaggerated. But it would be good if we were to pay attention to the fact that across the last several thousand years, every time a technologically advanced civilization or species encountered a less advanced civilization or species, the less advanced ones suffered very, very badly. And that's 100% of the time. Given that, perhaps we should have a little bit of a conversation before running through the jungle going, yoo-hoo, especially since we're learning so fast.
Yes.
That's the thing. Just 20 years ago, we knew of no planets outside our solar system. Now we know of almost 10,000.
Right.
Yeah.
So at this rate of learning, why not listen and learn so that our children will have the option, with all that added information, of deciding for themselves whether they want to shout yoo-hoo.
I'll tell you why.
That seems eminently sensible. It does,
and that's why you don't do it, because recklessness is far more exciting, David.
Yeah,
Let's just get it out there. Show the whole universe, like, you know, when you say reveal, forget reveal. Let's flash the universe. We're here.
Oh, you're so bold, Chuck. Wow. This also happens to be coming up at a time when we are faced with a range of global issues that require us to try to have some sort of global decision-making or global consultative process. I'm talking about global warming and other issues. It wouldn't hurt for us to learn how to at least attempt to make some sort of a global decision about things.
Right.
You're never going to reach a perfect consensus with every villager of every place on Earth, but you can at least make an honest attempt.
Yes, absolutely. And by the way, David, you are a science fiction writer, and I just want to say that I'm about to submit a treatment for Disney's Cosmic Jungle Book, which I think is brilliant, you just came up with.
Can I write the songs?
Let me tell you something. There's room for everybody on this train.
Excellent.
So let's move on.
Let's jump into another question.
And this is from Shelly Sock. Shelly Sock at Shelly Sock on Twitter. She said, "What would you most want to know about the aliens, and for them to know about us?" So in the game of getting to know you, what are the two most important things that you think should be in that exchange?
Yeah, good question, Shelly. What would we most want to know about them, and what would we most want them to know about us?
I mean, how about you personally, and of course, David Brin, too, personally.
So my personal, if I could ask him one thing, it would be, how did you do it? How did you survive with a technological civilization? Because I'm assuming, and there's good math behind this, that anybody we hear from has had a technological civilization for quite some time. Mm-hmm. They're not brand new babies like us. And therefore, they've solved this riddle that we're struggling with now. How do you have this exponentially increasing more and more powerful technology and yet not somehow, and yet use it to survive, not to do yourself in? You could easily see we could do one or the other. I'm thinking somebody we hear from has learned how to use technology in a mature way,
right?
Learned how to handle this global civilization puzzle. So if I could ask them one thing, it'd be like, hey, you got any tips for us? How do we do this?
Nice.
David Brin, what would you most like to know about them?
Well, I would ask, I'm a little bit persnickety. I would ask, why do we have to ask you for that help? Why weren't you helping us all along?
What took you so long?
Where the hell were you?
Never been a believer in ancient aliens. The whole notion that we deprecate ourselves is a good thing. We flagellate ourselves about how we aren't living up to our hopes and dreams. But to be honest, as animals go, we're actually pretty damn nice, and we've tried very, very hard. And I look across the last 6,000-8,000 years, because I've been around the whole time, and at all the hardworking, desperately eager, well-meaning people who piled rocks on rocks on rocks to make pyramids in appeals to some kinds of godlike beings to come and help us. And to be honest, we advanced to this level ourselves. And in my opinion, that's a point of pride. Nice. It's a fantastic accomplishment. And I'm not going to let aliens claim credit for it.
I like the way you think. That's really good stuff.
We're learning a lot about David Brin here, by the way. Not only does he find humans really interesting, but he's been here for at least 6,000 years. So the plot thickens.
The very beginning of the Earth itself, 6,000 years.
yeah, right.
Hey, you know what? On that note, let me just, I want to do something with you guys because, you know, in reading both of your materials, one thing, and seeing you both talk, you know, deliver your talks, what I find that you both have in common as a thread is this tremendous amount of positivity, and your look and outlook perspective on life here on Earth and the universe itself is extremely positive. And right now we live in probably one of the most negative times that I can remember. You know, I'm not that old, but still, I can't. It's so palpable, the negativity that we're experiencing primarily through the media. So I wanted to do something with you guys, a little something called the genius pep talk. Okay. Now you guys are the geniuses. And so what I'd like you to do is to, you know, in a very succinct fashion, tell the world, all of us listening, why it's going to be okay. Well, it's going to be okay, but why is it going to be okay?
Yeah, now could we cue the Bob Marley? Don't worry about a thing.
Exactly.
Every little thing is going to be all right.
There you go, right.
But without singing it, and I'm very interested to hear David's answer to this, and I a lot of my thinking has been influenced over the years by reading what he has to say about such matters. But I would say that you're right. People are focused on the negative, on the obstacles we face. We do face some serious obstacles. I mean, you know, climate change, say no more, and population. And, you know, there are a lot of scary aspects to our existence right now. On the other hand, I think a lot of that negativity comes from thinking very small and being obsessed with what's going on right now and what's the prospects are for the next few years. Mm-hmm. But if you take the longer view, the 5,000-year, the 10,000-year, the million-year view, and you look at the progress of the human race, and David alluded to this, we are a problem-solving species. We have faced bigger obstacles than we're facing now. The human race has almost gone extinct before, and we survived by reinventing ourselves and finding new ways to cooperate together. If you look at our long-term, I'm talking million-year history now. That's who we are. We're the problem-solving, inventive species. And I think that we're just faced with another set of challenges now, and that we'll look back at this time a few centuries from now and go, wow, they really thought they were stuck with that silly energy system that was messing up their atmosphere before they invented the... And then now everything's fine. We were inventive.
Right.
And people are recognizing collectively, globally, that we're in the situation we're in now. And I think that recognition will breed solutions. And I, even if the next century is troubling, and it may well be, I predict that the next millennium is going to be a really bright one for the human species.
Fantastic. Well done. I'm going to sum up what you said by Dr. David Grinspoon says, human beings, like Madonna's career, we're always reinventing ourselves. So...
There you go. David Brin, tell us why the future is not nearly as bad as some people like to say it is.
This is the dawning of the age of Aquarius.
See, he's singing too.
All right. Look, the thing is that I agree with everything that David said, but the problem is human beings get into traps. And one of the traps that we've seen for the last 6,000 years has been feudal pyramids of power that become hyper-conservative and then constrain and repress our creativity and our innovation. The great historian Arnold Toynbee said, those civilizations that thrive are those that invest in the rambunctious creative minorities. And we've created a civilization that's good at that. It's the only diamond shape human civilization in which a well-off middle class is unafraid of the rich and outnumbers the poor. And that's ours. And it's an experiment. It's a revolution. And we didn't look at it a revolution. And there are those in our society right now that are trying to destroy our confidence and hammer us back into the feudal pyramid that's the traditional human modality. And if that happens, I think that they will squash our creativity enough that we could be in very serious trouble. And I think that's one of the reasons why there's been a lot of propaganda, not just on the right, but also on the far left, that has been gloom and doom and anti-science. When in fact, we're a scientific people, we're a brave people, we're a competent and explorational people. And 2015 was the best year for exploration in the history of our species. So it's not just humanity that has to be resilient and innovative, but this particular culture has to regain its confidence, its belief that we are the bold scientific revolutionaries who can change everything.
I think we get the gist of what you're saying about humanity here, and that you feel as though we're actually full of promise, and we really appreciate your perspective here. Would love to hear more about it, and but we have to wrap up now. Thank you all so much for joining us today. This has been Star Talk All Star. I'm David Grinspoon on Twitter at Dr. Funky Spoon, my co-host Chuck Nice Twitter at Chuck Nice Comic, and our guest today has been David Brin on Twitter at David Brin. Until next time, this is Star Talk All Stars.
This is Star Talk.
Look around. You can find cars like these on Auto Trader. Like that car riding your tail. Or if you're tailgating right now, all those cars doubling as kitchens and living rooms are on Auto Trader too. Are you working out and listening to this ad at the same time? Well, multitasking pro, cars like the ones in the gym parking lot are for sale on Auto Trader. New cars, used cars, electric cars, maybe even flying cars. Okay, no flying cars, but as soon as they get invented, they'll be on Auto Trader. Just you wait. Auto Trader.
Whether you're a morning person or a bedtime procrastinator, everyone deserves a mattress that works for their style. And you'll find the best mattress for you at Ashley. The new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley brings you one-of-a-kind body-conforming technology, making every sleep tailored to be your best. The collection also features cool-to-the-touch covers and motion absorption to help minimize sleep disruptions from partners, pets, or kids. Shop the all-new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley. For the love of home.